Access number 28674, Mr. Richard Corsbrook, Reel 8. Now, what happened? You were down as G2 at the Baghdad signal office. From when about would that be, roughly?
It was before... the consequential stories of these come up. I was well established in Baghdad by the time I took UK leave in November. Now, that means that I'd gone down... The 6 month rule was being rigidly applied. The war had ended in, let's say, June, beginning of June. We were due out of Tehran by the beginning of December. I was well and truly established as G2 signals by by November, 17th of November, because by the 17th of November, I had come back on this strange UK leave that they...
Now, hang on, we'll come back to that. So how did you settle in at Baghdad? I mean, was it any...
Oh,
different?
Very good. I was in a houseboat.
Tell us about
on
that.
On the Tigris. Well, there's very few things I remember about it, but except it was a very comfortable little houseboat on the opposite side of the river to the city, as it then was. And there wasn't so much... I can't identify the city from current... where I was from current maps. But there was a city with some of the hotels. And across the river, we were in this houseboat. Very comfortable. I don't know.
Yeah, lots of officers in there. I mean.
Oh, yes. It was the ex-mess, the headquarters... one of the headquarters messes. I mean, there were... And... I was there for a time. I just remember it in this houseboat. I remember two things. One, we managed to break the engine of a speedboat that some other major had acquired, probably not legitimately, and we ran the big ends on it by taking it out without checking the oil. Because the Tigris, there's quite a nice ride river, and you could go and play on it. And we were rescued by, of all things, a Salvation Army party that were out in another boat. And the other was that this mess, they must have had some connections with a dairy farm on that side of the river. They produced delicious, because we did not get fresh butter. And this was real, what I would call, farm creamy fresh butter. There's things you remember. We'd have had to go across drive along the Tigris, cross the bridge, and go back into the city. Can't remember the detail of the headquarters.
Was the work just the same?
Just the same. It was obviously it was a bit more there was a more complicated network there, but it was still what you might call a supervising communications engineer. There was a requirement to provide line communication to the army, and one was responsible for the staff work in that connection.
Now, tell me about, so the next thing really would be this leave, wouldn't it?
Well, yes. Then, while we were there, I was regularly beaten at squash by the brigadier, who was much older than I was. Well, I was only 20-something, and he was 40-something. Oh, it's just an incidental. We used to go and play squash at the Alwia Club, Alwiayah, well-known, colonial-type club that was...
Was squash a popular game by then?
Oh, yes, for the likes of people who... Yes, it was popular then to the extent that you could... If you were an army headquarters and you had connect, I mean, you're in a city where there is an expats club, and who has a squash court, and you played it, and this would have been true in a lot of places of India, and there wasn't anything like it in Basra, because Basra was a bit of a non-place, but Baghdad had been established for yonks. There were quite a few characters around up there, and I've never been able to can't remember the full details. There was a venerable lady who lived in the Alweer Club, and I've never seen any reference to her since. But you know, it was a colonial existence to some extent. But anyway, we're getting on because we're still doing the same job. I mean, the job, to some extent, is uneventful. But what the army did about that as the war ended was, they obviously had the plan, was to get the Middle East troops back in turn on a month's leave in the United Kingdom by a torturous route. If you were in Basra or Baghdad, if you were in Iraq or Persia, by getting you across to Cairo, putting you on a boat to the south of France, in the widest sense, putting you on a train across France, and then a boat across the Channel, and a train up to Victoria. Now, that was called Medlock. Now, what it stood for, Middle East Leave Medlip, something like Middle East Leave in lieu of Python. Python was the code name for complete repatriation, you know, once and for all. You'll go home on DMOP. Medlap, or whatever, however it sounds, was the month's leave you got. And I mean, you didn't have to do anything except not, you know, if you didn't want to go, you said you didn't. Your name would came up eventually, based on how long you'd been out there, and based on how long you'd been out there, not particularly on who you were. Now, I managed to, presumably because of rank, managed to persuade somebody, headquarters, the local, presumably the staff, the local staff headquarters, that I was much too important to hang up, to go off on a lorry across the desert. They let me fly to Cairo now I've got to get where we are at the moment, because I've got to cover three trips out of Iraq to the East Bay. Yes, and I flew from I think I flew from Baghdad, didn't really matter, in a Lockheed, the passenger version of the Lockheed Hudson, which it was a Lockheed Hudson, but it was a passenger version, and managed to get halfway across the desert to the Sinai Desert, or desert, not the Sinai Desert, desert to Palestine, and then one of the engines broke, so we limped into Tel Aviv, and carried on next day to Cairo, and then sat and waited for a boat. Don't remember the details of the boat, except that it could not have been particularly uncomfortable. It doesn't register at all. But the end of the trip does, because we got to Toulon, and by God, it was bloody cold. We were put in a transit camp up on a hill in Toulon. And before we went to it was a sort of dormitory type, I don't remember, it was hutted, just about hutted or tented. We'd soaked up a lot of the local brandy, and as we went to bed and as we thawed out, we got drunker and drunker, and we were dozing off to sleep, singing our heads off. Then the train across to across France, Not, can't remember too much about that. And home we don't think we spent the night. We may have got straight on. Anyway, I ended up in Victoria and had got a phone message through from somewhere to my wife-to-be. And my God, there she was on time on Victoria Station as I came in on it was a classic. Platform 1, meet me under the clock, and Platform 1 on Victoria Station at about 8 o'clock at night, and my God, I made it. That was the first of the trips across. I got married, went back, and
you got married on that trip.
I got married on that trip, first wife. Got married on that trip, and went back. Don't remember any particular details. Going back, there's silly things you do remember. They'd managed to recruit, or not the word recruit, they managed to enlist onto the troop trains in France some of the LMS kitchen cars. And I remember a bloody great tea urn in the middle of one of these, whatever the code number for a kitchen, MS kitchen car is, making tea. back. But another boat trip that I can't clearly remember, so it must have been comfortable and uneventful. A couple of nights, obviously, to get from south of France to Cairo, or Port Said. Well, when I got back to Port Said, one waited for the next bit of transport. As a train trip along the Suez Canal coming into mind somewhere, but they sent for me from the office and said, You're going back to Baghdad by plane. Oh, that's very nice. Thank you very much. So it was an RAF Dakota, not as comfortable as the Lodestar, Lockheed Lodestar. That's what it was, wasn't it? Anyway, I got back to Baghdad in time for Christmas, and when I got there, I said, who the hell fixed this? He said, well, one of the other office staff said, well, we thought you'd want to be back here in time for Christmas, so we asked for you to be hurried up. So I got back to Baghdad in time for Christmas. By May, I've got to have got myself back to the UK. So between soon after the new year of 46, I went down to Basra as the remaining signals staff officer in Persia and Iraq. And that means that by that time, the whole of the we had virtually fallen back, if you were under pressure, down to Basra. But I closed up. Oh, no, I didn't close up, because I handed over to somebody else the office in Basra, which was responsible, effectively, for coordinating the signals requirements for the staff. And was down there until round about May.
So you just went back. Was there much work to do in Basra? I mean, it's a bigger area of
interest. No, I mean, it was the whole commitment was for collapsing. As I say, I'd love to see some of the war diaries, because I'd know how much I was doing. Because I can't remember any events down there. It was all closing up and signal, closing up the signal requirement. I am surprised sitting here now how quickly they appear to have, you know, the fact that the signals in that part of the world could be coordinated by one single major is amazing. They never let go anywhere so quickly these days. But that there wasn't another headquarters there. The Baghdad headquarters, if the headquarters had gone, there might have been some representation. We'd given up all the telephone line. We'd sold the telephone line from Baghdad, but from the Persian frontier to Tehran. We'd sold it to the Persian telephone companies. And apparently...
Who arranged all that?
We did. We, the headquarters office, CSO, we negotiated and arrived at some sort of price, which is hardly, you know, it was really hardly a price. It was a suggestion, well, shall we leave it? We'd argue about where the terminal was going to be. Were you going to take it over from there or there? But they in principle took over the line. And when the colonel went back a few weeks later, he said they got the bloody thing working. So they were not as stupid as they looked. That was a lie. As I say, I don't know where we picked it. Must have picked it up from the Persian border.
Now, what happened then?
Well, then you're going to get... I think we're coming to a natural break at the moment, in a minute. From Baghdad, from Basra, I packed my bags, and that was a joke in itself. I got Persian carpets, radios, and had managed to accumulate masses of boxes, all of which, some of which were in the loft, all of which got put on, sent home. It was extraordinary, isn't it, those days. You were coming home. Right, you had to carry with you your personal bedroll and kit bag, if you had a kit bag. Okay, but I had boxes of stuff. I had Persian carpets, one of which is upstairs still. The others are in my daughter's kitchen in Matlock. I had radios, and all into a variety of... I had a large wooden box, which I think was our security box in the office. And that came home, and tin box trunks, which I had variously collected at various points, all packed up, sent off, and then I had to get myself home. So somehow or other, I managed to persuade the powers that be, such as they were, that I had to go back by air. So I flew. Oh, this was great! I flew to Cairo in one of the Empire flying boats.
And this is May 46.
This is May 46. That was that was the best air flight I've ever had. It took off from the Shatt Al Arab in... You know what I mean by the Shatt Al Arab, don't you? First World War and all that. I took off from the Shatt Al Arab and landed at Habaneer, and then landed again in Cairo. In Cairo? Yes, it must have been Cairo, not Portside. And the boat home, but it was a very respectable way to fly, and it was, you know, it was real pre-war, almost pre-war flying.
And the rest of the journey went well as well?
Well, the rest of the journey, no, can't remember any stags. And home. I suppose we had disembarkation leave or something. That's right, I'd put in... My wife then, having got a wife, she was working in Southport. Now, it's one of these stupid things. You put down, where would you like to be? And they managed to find you somewhere inconvenient, Well, one goes back, one has one's leave, one reports to somewhere. I can't remember. I reported to a deployment branch in Thirsk. I was in Thirsk, and you asked where would you like to be, and I said, well, Southport, which is silly because, and got posted to the School of Signals at Catterick. So I've gone back to the School of Signals. I haven't had a very ambitious life. You've been to the School of Signals, gone abroad, and really effectively come back. Job for you at School of Signals, you've got to revert from major to captain because your promotion is, you're not war substantive and all that. Anyway, and I'm given charge, that's absolute lark, given charge of what's called a user trials section. Now, this was a Royal Signals user trials section. What it was exactly what it says. If something new was coming on the market that was a possibility for use by the signals, you had to go out and test it. Well, that's an excuse for all the jollies in the world.
This was new commercially available equipment.
Available, whether it's commercially or not, it's being developed. It's a fact the job I ended up doing for the General Electric Company, but effectively from guided weapon trials. So this was an absolute doddle. School of Signals, not quite as comfortable as the School of Signals had been when we were there on the course 3 or 4 years earlier. But still fairly respectable.
Now, what kind of new equipment? Do you remember any of the things you tested?
Oh, yes. Duracell batteries. This was the first of the... I mean, yeah, no other things as well. Duracell batteries, which were... Well, they're just the same. I think they didn't look... Which you use mercury, they had just come in. So, you know, these are proposed for use. Before that, the army had used the Clarche type, the ordinary elk, whatever these are. Now, mercury free. They have to sell them as mercury free. In those days, mercury was the good thing to have in a battery because it made it last longer. And I remember we did, well, what do you do? You put the battery on test, and you put it on test, and you put a load on it, and you measure it. I've done the same thing with these batteries, just to find which are the cheapest ones in the market. I did that. That was a lab-based job. But much more exciting was the trials we ran. It's amazing to think that it was 1945... but they still hadn't got a radio teleprinter link. I'm being a bit technical here, but considering where we've got to now with the internet and heaven knows where, the only way you could work a teleprinter in those days, the Americans were better at it than we were, was to connect them by wire. And there wasn't a reliable radio teleprinters network. So somebody had come up with a box of tricks which purported to be the terminal units for use between teleprinter, army wireless set, and you could put these in, they put this in between and it would frequency shift, I think it was frequency, it doesn't, probably technicalities don't really matter, but I think it was frequency shift keying into the army, classic army wireless set, and I think we used number 9 sets for the trial. So we got our teleprinter and we got our prototype boxes. We left one set up at Catterick, and then we all got in our. Then being the boss, I decided to what the best job to do was to go and get the hell out of it. We took took about three vehicles and all the kit, and we set off down the Great North Road. And periodically we pitch camp, or metaphorically stop. The boys, I had got my a wireless truck fitted out to sleep in. The lads were sleeping in a three-tonner. And wherever we got to, we'd get to a point and say, we'll set up. We will put the aerial up and we'll try to work back to, and we worked our way up the Great North Road, down the Great North Road towards London, test transmitting as we went, but at every stop. I remember we stopped at Stilton. Oh no, we stopped at Pontefract and got hopelessly drunk in one of the pubs in Pontefract.
Now, how was it effective? Did it work?
Not very well. I remember we halfway along, somewhere, Stilton, I think it was, we got to Stilton. Wouldn't recognise it now because they've gone and built that new bloody great new motorway. I had a friend at left one of my friends at when I'd left Catterick on the way south. I said, well, we're going to the theatre in London. What should we do? You see, well, this hadn't been resolved, and I remember trying to get in touch with Jake on the teleprinter because he went to the test site that I had there, and he trying to agree which theatre to go to. But I think it was a play called Clutterbuck, and I remember rightly Clutterbuck, buck. Did it work? It stopped working. Then we did. Then we took it to Barnes Common, and my wife lived in Barnes, or her parents did. So we thought Barnes Common was a good place to have put the aerial up, and it didn't work from there. It wasn't a great success, but it was the prototype, and I think in those days we didn't try very hard.
Any other things you were testing?
Well, yes. Well, this one was very. This was more This is interesting from a technical point of view more than anything that happened. Marconi, my eventual employers, had developed an add-on goodie for a range of big transmitters, SWB, SWAB transmitters, shortwave broadcast transmitters, which the Army used at headquarters around the world. They wanted to, in order to get more information over a circuit, one of the techniques you can use is to go to single sideband working instead of double. The average broadcast, or the AM broadcast, is double sideband, so you can get twice as much information if you can put go single sideband, because you can fill one sideband with information and another lot of information on the other sideband. And they'd produced a kit that converted these transmitters to single sideband working. So we had done I went up with a sergeant and a couple of corporals to Chelmsford to learn about this at the Chelmsford, the now unfortunately long gone Chelmsford Works. And we fitted up, I remember fitting up fitting up something somewhere, because I had my gramophone with me and we played records over the network. That was another excuse, of course. That was good excuse for trogging up between London and between Catterick and Chelmsford fairly frequently. And at some point, I remember putting a playing, putting a gramophone pickup and gramophone on, and using that as a test transmission. But I can't remember where we did it. But that was an excuse for riding up and down the country. I don't remember specifically many other particular outings.